Lecture 5, DNA Structure and Replication.
Welcome back. My last two lectures have concerned the search for the genetic material, for the mechanism of heredity. First, we found it in cells, then in the nucleus of the cell, then in chromosomes of the nucleus, then in a region of the chromosome. Remember that sex-determining region in the Y chromosome. In the last lecture, we found it inside the nucleus as DNA, and I described experimental evidence in several different systems for DNA as the gene. Now let's see what DNA really is and how its structure fulfills the requirements we have for the genetic material. My opening story concerns the Iceman. In 1991, a group of hikers in the Alps between Austria and Italy spotted a corpse frozen in the ice. There were some tools and a dagger nearby. The body was carefully removed, and 4 days later, the body, now known as the Iceman, was at the University of Innsbruck in Austria. Scientists determined that this body was 5,000 years old. It was a male and had been killed by an arrow, so he was a victim of homicide, and then somehow froze into the ice. There are many remarkable things about the Iceman, but to me the most remarkable is his DNA was preserved in his bones, virtually intact. When scientists looked at the information content of his DNA, they found that this information content placed him smack in the genetic group of the current Europeans who live in the Alpine regions of Europe. So this is one of the forefathers of the people who currently live there. That DNA can last so long is testimony to its durability. It's nice to have a genetic material that will be stable and not break down very readily. The structure of DNA is testimony to something else. I call DNA a secular icon in our society. Now, what's an icon? An icon is an image or symbolic representation that is often used in sacred situations. In this case, it's secular. The 20th century had two great icons that symbolized science in the public mind. One is the atom with the whizzing electrons going around a nucleus. The other is DNA with this double helix. People now talk about DNA all the time as a shorthand. An advertisement for a financial services company tells customers, "We understand the DNA of business." A perfume that I actually tried, didn't go over big, is called DNA. And on the bottle it says, "This is the essence of life." Didn't enliven me up very much at all. There is a media software system called the DNA server. There's a clothing line called DNA Divewear, and it advertises that this is the genetic design extreme behavior. And of course, there's the original biotechnology company whose stock market symbol is, you guessed it, DNA. DNA is the subject of artists as well. Salvador Dali used the DNA double helix in some of his art. There is a portrait in England of the Nobel laureate, Sir John Sulston, who worked on cell cycling, cell division in yeast cells. And what it has is parts of his DNA inside of bacterial cells in the portrait. A Brazilian artist named Eduardo Koch used the chemical building blocks of DNA to translate verses of the Bible. And viewers looking at this work of art can change the DNA and change the verses that it represents at will. I've seen playgrounds with slides shaped in the helical form of DNA. And of course, it's hard to visit a pharmaceutical company or biotechnology laboratory that doesn't have a DNA sculpture somewhere. So DNA really is everywhere in our society these days. Now I want to talk about DNA structure in terms of its function as genetic material in three ways. And first I'll describe the early studies that suggested its structure. And I'll take you through how we determine what DNA was structurally. Then I'll describe some of the properties of DNA as a double helix. And finally, I'll describe how this double helix structure of DNA fulfills the requirements of genetic material that I talked about in the last lecture. First, the early studies of DNA structure. I mentioned in the last lecture that Friedrich Miescher was the first person to isolate DNA from cell nuclei. Miescher is a very interesting man. He was the son of a doctor and graduated from medical school at the top of his class at the University of Basel. Unfortunately, Miescher was partially deaf and decided for this reason not to pursue clinical medicine. Today, many physicians who have handicaps are in medicine. In those days, it was wise not to do so. So instead, Miescher chose a career in research. He began working on the chemistry of the cell nucleus, about which people knew nothing. His mentor was a world famous at that time German biochemist named Ernst Felix Hopseiler. In fact, Hopseiler is so famous, there's a journal called Hopseiler's Journal of Biochemistry, which until recently was called that name. Now it has a different name. For some reason, they wanted a shorter title, maybe for indexing purposes. Working in Hopseiler's laboratory, Miescher in 1868 isolated nuclei from the cells of blood that was on dressings at a nearby military hospital. So from these dressings, he got white blood cells, isolated their nuclei, and then from the nuclei, he busted them open and extracted a substance that was rich in the usual things that you find in biological molecules, carbon, hydrogen, oxygen. But two other elements were there, phosphorus and nitrogen. Because this substance was in the nucleus, he called it nuclein. One of his students later called it nucleic acid. And later on, when we found out what it was made of course, it turned out to be DNA. Now, Miescher's boss, Hopseiler, was so amazed at this new substance. It formed these long, long fibers. DNA is not that hard to isolate. I've done it with grade school students. It's so easy. These long fibers impressed the boss, Hopseiler, so much that before he let Miescher publish his work, he went into the lab personally and repeated all of Miescher's experiments. This was so novel, Hopseiler wanted to make darn sure that this stuff is for real. Well, he repeated all of Miescher's work and then allowed Miescher to publish the research. Nucleic acid was a curiosity, even though Hopseiler had published it as something in the nucleus, until it was realized sometime in the next 30 years after this. Remember, this is the mid to late 1800s, that the genetic material is in the nucleus. You remember those experiments I described of nuclear transplants and of regenerating cells, and that genetic material is in the nucleus and that's species specific. So right away, when people found DNA in the nucleus, they said, this is a candidate for the genetic material. But I mentioned previously that there's not just DNA inside the nucleus, there are proteins as well. So people wanted to find out, well, which one is it? Now, we know the answer in advance, but I want to take you through some of the reasoning that led to that answer. Especially the chemical reasoning. Because it's important that we understand the chemistry of DNA, not down to the last atom, but in terms of its information content and what it can do in terms of genetics. In the 1890s, a chemist, Albrecht Kussel, found that DNA was a polymer. Now there's a new word for you. A polymer can be considered like beads on a chain. The long chain is the polymer. The individual beads that make up the chain are monomers. So monomer and polymer. And that DNA fibers that Miescher had isolated were these long, long polymers of probably millions of units of monomers. And the monomers were the things that had nitrogen in them, as well as carbon and hydrogen and oxygen. And there were four what are called nitrogen bases that made up DNA. These are bases, as the spelling in the bases on a baseball diamond. And they're called adenine, thymine, guanine, and cytosine. Now, we abbreviate them A, T, G, and C. Those are the different monomers that make up DNA. So if we're talking about a long chain, we only have four types of beads in it. Red, orange, yellow, and green, let's say, right? And so our chain is made up of information that contains red, orange, yellow, and green. And so the chain might be red, orange, yellow, green, red, green, orange, yellow, red. I'm not going to continue on that. There can be very many different orders of the beads on the chain in different amounts. Let me give you the names of the four of them again, and then I will not mention the names again in the course. I'll just call them A, adenine, T, thymine, G, guanine, and C, cytosine. Students often are so used to the shorthand of A, T, G, and C, they think they're part of the alphabet and they don't stand for substances, complex molecules in themselves. So I wanted you to give them a name. Between 1900 and 1930, working at the Rockefeller Institute in New York, a nuclear chemist named Phoebus Levine spent 30 years studying DNA. Levine found that the four monomers, those bases A, T, G, and C, were not linked to each other in DNA. Instead, they were attached to a backbone. And the backbone was made up of a sugar and a phosphate group. Phosphate is phosphorus with oxygens attached. And the sugar is a multi-carbon molecule that has 5 carbons and 10 oxygens and 10 hydrogens and 5 oxygens. The sugar is called deoxyribose, and so the name deoxyribonucleic acid. Deoxyribose is the sugar. Nucleic acid is the name that Miescher's student gave to this stuff. Deoxyribonucleic acid was coined for this stuff by Levine, and it was called from then on DNA. Levine, again, showed that the bases A, T, G, and C are not directly hooked onto each other, but are hooked onto this boring backbone of sugar and phosphate. So it's kind of like a chain that is a gold chain that has little subchains hanging from it, and then the beads are on the subchains. And the gold chain can be the sugar phosphate backbone, and then the beads hanging off of those individual chains are the bases, A, T, G, and C. Now, Levine proposed that DNA was indeed a very, 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 very long polymer, and it consisted of repeating units. And he said the repeating unit was A, T, G, C. So we could define a DNA molecule as ATGC, 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 and as I ask my students, can I stop now? And some of them say yes, and thank God then I stop. If they don't say yes, I keep going for the hour. So it was just a repeating unit of ATGC, according to Levine. If Levine was correct, Remember, this is about 1930. And Levine certainly thought he was correct. This meant that DNA lacked the variable information content to be the genetic material. Something as boring as that, same unit repeated many times, that's not going to give 24,000 genes or even 1,000 genes. Levine was a towering intellect, a stupendous chemist, a strong personality. So people believed him. I like to think in terms of nucleic acid, Levine is the Aristotle of the early 20th century. So everybody said, well, that's it for DNA. That's not going to be genetic material. Levine said it's just repeating units of ATGC. So people started looking at proteins for the genetic material. Now, this is the 1930s. And remember, DNA was not identified experimentally until the mid-40s as a genetic material in the bacteria transformation experiment. In the late 1940s, another great biochemist took a stab at DNA by the name of Erwin Chargaff, working at Columbia University. Chargaff found that Levine was wrong about the polymer of DNA. It wasn't ATGC, ATGC at all. It was highly variable. So if our DNA starts with ATGC, Chargaff said, oh no, it's ATGCTTCAATACCA. Did you get that exactly? GCTTA. It was highly variable. A very important finding because right away people said, whoa, there's a terrific information content here. Chargaff made other discoveries whose significance came to be fully appreciated shortly afterwards. First of all, for each species he examined, when he chopped up the DNA into individual beads, monomers, he found a constant ratio of the proportion of bases. So for every human being, there was a certain percentage of A that was the same, a certain percentage of T, a certain percentage of G, and a certain percentage of C. They added up to 100%. For each eucalyptus plant, there was a different percentage of A, but T, G, and C. The second thing chemically that Chargaff found was that the ratios of A and T and G and C were the same. That is, if the species had 20% A, there would be about 20% T. Therefore, because we're going to have to 100%, 30% G and 30% C. So A was always equal to T in proportions, and G was always equal to C. Another species, another creature, might have 18% A and 18% T. And of course, 32% G and 32% C. And now here's your homework assignment. 15% A, tell me the T, G, and C. Hand in the answer tomorrow, send it to the teaching company. Now the problem was fitting all of these observations together. Physical chemists came into the picture now. Not biochemists who look at what things are, but physical chemists who look at the arrangement of atoms in three-dimensional space. Consider water. Water is H2O. There's an O with a couple of H's attached. It's very regularly shaped. All water molecules are the same. Now consider DNA. Millions of atoms. Was there a regular shape to DNA? Well, there's a physical way to examine DNA. And that's by shining X-rays on the DNA molecule when it's in a solid form. Now, an X-ray is shown on a DNA molecule in a solid form. What happens is the rays go into DNA and then they get bounced around by all the atoms that are there. And then they come out the other end. Now, if we put a photographic plate at the other end, we're going to get a pattern depending on how much bouncing around that ray has gone through. So the ray goes through the DNA molecule, then it bounces. And you get these what are called X-ray patterns. And the X-ray pattern of DNA was very regular. Two scientists working at King's College London in the early 1950s, Rosalind Franklin and Maurice Wilkins, did X-ray analyses of DNA and found a regularity that they interpreted to be in the shape of a helix, a coil. So now we had a lot of evidence for the shape of DNA as a helix. We had a sugar phosphate backbone that Levine had found. We had A equals T and G equals C that Chargaff had found. Working at Cambridge University, up the road from London, a young American geneticist, James Watson, and a somewhat older British physicist, Francis Crick, looked at all of this evidence and came up with an inspiring idea. Maybe, just maybe, DNA is a double helix, that there are two polymers here, and that the sugar and phosphate are on the outside, the regular sugar phosphate, and the bases are on the inside. And to show that this might be true, Watson and Crick made ball and stick models of the bases of DNA and the sugar and phosphate and tried to fit them together tightly. And the only way they would fit together as a double helix was by having the sugar and phosphate on the outside and the bases on the inside, and the A's and T's just fit together. And the G's and C's just fit together, like a ball into a baseball mitt. Now they fit. They didn't bond very tightly. They fit very weakly together, but they fit. No other type of structure worked than the double helix. Crick's wife was an artist, and she drew a double helical shape with the bases on the inside and the ribbon on the outside being the sugar and phosphate for the article they published in the spring of 1953. It's a one-page brief article describing the evidence and their proposal for the double helix model. This model was immediately accepted as the model for the genetic material, not only for its science, but for its elegance. It's a beautiful structure. And of course, this brief one-page paper won them the Nobel Prize. Nobel Prize is given for people who think, not necessarily for people who do a lot of grunt work in the laboratory. The DNA double helix fulfills the requirements for the genetic material. Now, what are those requirements? There are four of them. First, DNA should have a huge information content. Second, DNA can be accurately replicated. Third, DNA should be expressed as the phenotype. And fourth, you should be able to mutate DNA to change it and get genetic mutation. I'm going to deal with the three of the four now, and I will defer to the next lecture the aspect of expressing DNA as the phenotype. First, the information content of DNA. Well, this really came from Chargaff, as I mentioned. DNA has a huge information content. With just four bases in any amount, we can make all types of words, right? It's a language that has a great number of possibilities. So, for example, there are 469 base pairs of DNA in the insulin. Insulin is a hormone, and the gene that codes for insulin is 469 base pairs of DNA. Now, when we draw the structure of a DNA molecule, we go A, T, G, C, and I'm going to read out the beginning of the insulin gene. I'm reading you a human gene information content. A, G, C, 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 T, C, C, A, G, G, A, C. We assume the other strand is there. Now, how do I know what the other strand is? Everywhere there's an A, there's a T. A and T go together. Everywhere there's a G, there's a C. Right? So we know one strand, we know the other strand. Everywhere there's an A, there's a T in the other strand. Everywhere there's a G, there's a C in the other strand. Everywhere there's a C, there's a G in the other strand. Everywhere there's a T, there's an A on the other strand. So if we know one strand, we know the other. So generally, when biologists look at DNA sequences, they look at only one of the two strands of DNA. There's a huge information content. Humans have over 3 billion base pairs of DNA. So there's a lot of information there. We can get lots of different sequences out of DNA, the four bases. DNA replication. How is DNA duplicated? One of the great coy statements in the history of modern biology was the statement that Watson and Crick made in their paper where they unveiled the double helix model. They said it has not escaped our notice that the structure we propose will provide a mechanism for accurately replicating DNA, genetic material. What was not escaping their notice was that the double strands of DNA could unwind very easily. The base pairs of DNA, that is the A and the T that are inside the double helix, are weakly attached to each other. And so we can envision the two strands of DNA unzipping. So the two strands separate, and each one of the old strands can act as a template for the new strands. Let me give you an illustration of that. Let us say we have a DNA molecule, I'll make it really simple, that is AAAAA. The other strand of DNA, of course, will be TTTTTT, TTT, five of them, okay? Five T's to five A's. The strands unzip. Now on one side we have the AAAAA. On the other side we have the TTTTT. And now there should be an enzyme or a mechanism coming in to duplicate this, and the AAAAA here gets bonded to TTTTT, so now we have an AT double helix, and the TTTTT here gets bonded to AAA. And so we have a two new helices just by unwinding and replicating in that way. This is called semi-conservative replication, not because of the politics of the people who propose the model, but because you are semi-conservative. You are conserving both old strands of DNA, and you're adding the complementary or the opposite strand to the old strands of DNA. It's not like doing a Xerox copy. In a Xerox copy, we put the old copy on the machine and we get a brand new copy, right? So we have two copies, one old and one brand new. That would be conservative replication. It's not like that at all. It's semi-conservative, where DNA is retaining the old strand for the new strand. And there's a very interesting question we can ask about this, and that is the following. I am the product of a single cell, the fertilized egg. It had DNA in it from my mother and father. When that cell reproduced, each new cell, semi-conservative replication, had an old strand of DNA and a new strand of DNA. So in the early embryo, the first cell had both original strands of DNA, parental strands from mom and dad, and when it divided, reproduced, each new cell had one old strand and one new strand. When those new cells replicated, each one of those cells ended up with an old strand and a new strand, one new cell, and the other strand cell has, of course, two new strands because its second strand of DNA is new. So, is it possible that in my body still is my parents' DNA after all of those cell divisions? Answer, I guess it's possible. I haven't seen evidence that it's there. I haven't seen evidence that it isn't. But it would be nice to think that somewhere in my body might be a cell that contains the actual DNA from my parents and those 60 trillion cells. My third requirement for DNA, the other two that I've talked about are information content and accurate replication, is DNA mutation or changes that are permanent and passed on to the next generation. So we can envision a normal DNA sequence might be A, T, C, G, G, T, T, A, and you change it. Instead of A, T, C, G, it's A, T, C, A or something. You change one base pair in DNA. It turns out that the duplication mechanism of DNA is error-prone. Errors do happen. About 1 in a million times an error is made. Now, if you're replicating a billion building blocks, you're going to change 1 in a million. Most of these are repaired in DNA. So DNA is constantly being scanned by a system of DNA repair mechanisms that will remove the bad base and put in the good base. Now, how do we know a bad base? Well, if you put in a C opposite an A, normally you're supposed to put in a T opposite an A. Put in a C opposite an A, that's bad. There is actually scanning going on all the time along your DNA to repair those errors. Any errors that are not caught, of course, are passed on to the next cell and the next generation. This is the raw material for evolution and for genetic diversity. The fourth requirement for DNA as genetic material is the expression as the phenotype. That's the topic of my next lecture. Thank you.